let's start out by reviewing the difference between protein and non-protein coding genes. What does a non-protein coding gene code for? These gaps in the recordings are hard to listen to. No one? What does a protein coding gene code for? No. A protein coding gene is DNA. Non-protein coding genes code for RNA. What do protein coding genes code for? No. Protein coding genes are DNA. What did you say? Coding indirectly for a protein, but what do they directly code for, protein coding genes? No idea? We've talked about this several times already throughout the term, including the last time we met. They do, because proteins give organisms their traits, but a protein coding gene does not directly code for protein. It indirectly codes for protein. And you said what? Well, yes, but he correctly said that non-protein coding genes code for RNA. So what's the difference? Protein coding genes code directly for RNA. Non-protein coding genes code directly for RNA. What is the difference? Yeah.
Is it the type of RNA?
Yes.
Okay.
So what is the specific difference? Protein coding genes code directly for what specific kind of RNA?
mRNA.
mRNA, yes. Non-protein coding genes code for what? Well, the reason protein coding genes are called protein coding genes is because when they code for mRNA, the purpose of that mRNA is then to stand as a code for how to build a protein. Transcription results directly in mRNA. That's what transcription directly produces. For a protein coding gene, that transcription process produces messenger RNA. When a non-protein coding gene gets transcribed, what is produced? Well, is it mRNA? No, otherwise that gene would be a protein coding gene.
Not just regular RNA?
Not regular kind of RNA, any other kind of RNA. There is no regular or eccentric RNA. Protein coding genes code for messenger RNA, because messenger RNA is then involved in the process of producing a protein. A cell has no idea how to build messenger RNA unless it's told how to do so. That's the job of a protein coding gene. It tells the cell how to build messenger RNA. Well, how does the cell know how to build any other kind of RNA besides messenger RNA? Once again, it doesn't unless it's told how to do so. That's the job of non-protein coding genes. Non-protein coding genes code for all the other kinds of RNA other than messenger RNA. And in that case, transcription is the end of the line. Transcription results in the other kind of RNA besides messenger RNA, and that's the end of the job. Because you're just trying to produce that kind of RNA, right? But for a protein coding gene, transcription results in messenger RNA, and that's only part of the overall process. That's not the end goal, in other words, to build mRNA. The purpose of building mRNA is so that mRNA can then go on in the process of producing a polypeptide, which is the end goal. That's why such a gene is called a protein coding gene. It indirectly codes for a protein by directly coding for messenger RNA. Is that clear? All genes get transcribed. All genes in that transcription process produce RNA of some sort. Protein coding genes specifically code for messenger RNA. Are you sure that's clear? All right. Then let's restrict our attention for the rest of the chapter to protein coding genes, which, by the way, are the vast majority of genes in an organism. There are so many genes per species, almost all of those are protein coding genes. But that's not to say the non-protein coding genes aren't important. They're vitally important because you need the other kinds of RNA. It doesn't just pop into existence. The cell has to be able to know how to build those other RNAs, and that's what those genes are for. But usually when we use the word gene, we don't usually specify protein coding gene. Usually when we just say gene, we're referring to a protein coding gene. And that's what we'll be talking about for the rest of the chapter. A gene is said to be expressed if it's used. Now, the genes are there for the entire lifetime of the cell or organism. Right? The DNA stays with the cell, and in fact, in a multicellular organism in which cells come to the end of their own lifetime and produce new cells within the same organism, both of those two new cells have that DNA that lasts their whole lifetimes as well. So the DNA is always there. And the DNA includes genes. But those genes aren't necessarily always being expressed. In fact, most of the time they're not being expressed. They're just turned off, in other words. In other lectures, I have compared a gene to an instruction manual. Right? I've used this analogy before. An instruction manual, indirectly, for how to build a protein is what a protein coding gene is. An instruction manual found in a library. The library is the genome, which is all of the DNA in a single organism. And each of your cells individually has that entire library. But just like a real library, not all of the materials in the library are circulating, right? A circulating book is one that you're allowed to check out, take home. That's not what we're talking about here. There are non-circulating materials at a library, reference materials usually, that you're allowed to use while you're at the library, but they have to stay there. That's what these instruction manuals are like, non-circulating books. Each gene is like a single how-to manual for building a specific polypeptide indirectly. But really, it's the code for how to specifically build a messenger RNA molecule. All right? Now, if you have a how-to manual that's non-circulating in a library for how to build something, it's not going to do you any good unless you can memorize it while you're there, unless you write down those instructions so that you can take those instructions with you, because you can't take the manual. Well, that's exactly what transcription is like. And that's exactly why transcription was called this. This process we're looking at in slide 2 is an overall process called gene expression. Gene expression involves the gene, but the gene isn't involved in the entire process of gene expression. Gene expression refers to both of the processes listed here in the correct order. First, transcription, and then translation. Both of those add up to gene expression. Transcription and translation, notice, both start with T-R-A-N-S. So that means they can easily be confused if you don't put any meaning to these. If you just think of these things as not having any literal meaning, then yes, you're going to be confused, as you're going to forget which one is which. But they're words. They have everyday meaning. Think about what those mean, and that can help you remember which one is which. Transcription is the noun form of transcribe, the verb, right? What does it mean to transcribe?
Write down or copy.
Right. To rewrite something. Like if you are transcribing, in a sense, me right now, you're not writing every word I say. But that's what transcription is, right? If you order a transcript of a program, for instance, it's a written account of what was said in the program. And notice that you're staying in the same language when you're transcribing. You're just rewriting it. That's why they used the word transcription to describe what's happening biologically here. The original information, which is the gene, which is made of DNA nucleotides, is in the language of DNA nucleotides. Or it's in the language of nucleotides, right? A DNA sequence. If you rewrite that, you're transcribing it. Well, you're writing it, you're rewriting it in the language of nucleotides, but RNA nucleotides. Anyway, that's why they called it transcription. So that's like temporarily looking at the non-circulating reference book and writing those instructions down so that you can then take that with you and put the book back on the shelf. The gene is the DNA that's like the book. And once it gets read so that you can rewrite the code, DNA's job is done. And it can go back to just being DNA. It needs to be read one time to produce a transcript, as it's called, an mRNA transcript, the product of transcription. DNA's job is done because now the mRNA transcript has the code for how to build the protein. You don't need DNA after that point to build that protein, right? All you need is the mRNA information. Translation, as an everyday word, refers to a change in language, right? And that's because translation uses the information in messenger RNA to produce a polypeptide. And a messenger RNA, being a nucleic acid, is in the language of nucleotides. A polypeptide is in the language of amino acids, right? A polypeptide is built out of amino acids, not out of nucleotides. So that's why they use the word translation to describe this. You read the code from messenger RNA in the language of nucleotides, and you assemble something in the language of amino acids to build that polypeptide, to complete the process of gene expression. We have two cells shown here to represent the dichotomy of cell types that we keep talking about. So there's a prokaryotic cell on the top, a eukaryotic cell on the bottom. They both require gene expression for the same reasons, so that they can have their proteins to do the jobs that proteins do, which is everything that's important in a cell, right? But because of fundamental differences between the two cell types, there are some differences in how gene expression occurs. Transcription as a process by itself occurs basically the same way in the two. Translation occurs basically the same way in the two. But gene expression is slightly different in the two because of their fundamental difference, which is presence or absence of a nucleus, right? Prokaryotic cells do not have a nucleus, and therefore they have only one compartment, the cytoplasm. Eukaryotic cells have multiple compartments, including a nucleoplasm, which is the contents of the nucleus, and a cytoplasm outside of that. The reason this matters for gene expression is that gene expression includes transcription first and then translation. Any cell has to have transcription occur where the DNA is, because transcription directly involves the DNA. Translation in any cell occurs in the cytoplasm. That's where the polypeptide is actually assembled, on a ribosome, which is a little organelle, a molecular machine that assembles a polypeptide using the instructions in messenger RNA to do so. Well, for a prokaryotic cell, the cytoplasm, which is where translation, the second process, occurs, is the same compartment where the DNA is, which is where transcription has to occur. So in a prokaryotic cell, transcription and translation occur in the same compartment, and it's therefore simpler. A eukaryotic cell has to have transcription occur where the DNA is, but for a eukaryotic cell, that means in the nucleus. Therefore, the messenger RNA that gets produced by transcription in a eukaryotic cell is in the nucleus to begin with, and therefore has to leave the nucleus to get to the cytoplasm for translation to occur, because translation occurs in the cytoplasm. That's the extra complication in a eukaryotic cell for gene expression that a prokaryotic cell doesn't have, because it's not compartmentalized. And that's the major point of this figure, to show you that. So what is the impediment that a eukaryotic messenger RNA transcript faces that it does not face in a prokaryotic cell? Exactly. The nuclear envelope, the double membrane around the nucleus, is a boundary between the two compartments. And so the messenger RNA that's produced in the nucleus of a eukaryotic cell has to get through that nuclear envelope to get to the cytoplasm where translation can take place. And that's where all of the nuclear pores that I described when we first talked about organelles come into play. The doubly membrane-bounded nucleus, that nuclear envelope that is the boundary, is perforated. It's full of holes. But those holes aren't just gaps in the phospholipid bilayer. Each nuclear pore is a complex of proteins arranged in a circle so that it has a hollow interior, like a tunnel. That's how messenger RNA gets out of a nucleus of a eukaryotic cell to get to the cytoplasm. And so that involves something that occurs only in eukaryotic cells that we'll talk about in detail in just a little bit. All right, let's go to three. On the top here we see a short sequence of an overall chromosome. This is not even close to being the entire chromosome. You see three genes listed here. Well, one chromosome is one of however many that the species has, right? So first of all, there's multiple chromosomes in a eukaryotic cell. But anyway, just one chromosome can have thousands of genes on it. You see just three genes here. However long the chromosome is, though, it's one double-stranded DNA from end to end. One enormously long sequence of A's, T's, C's, and G's. Millions of nucleotides long. A gene is not something that you can look at structurally and say, this is a gene. A gene is simply some subset of those A's, T's, C's, and G's along the way. So a gene itself is nothing but A's, C's, T's, and G's, but it's not all of them. It's just some of them in the overall sequence that we call the chromosome. You have another gene somewhere down the line, which is another sequence. And between any two genes is also a sequence of A's, T's, C's, and G's. That's why you can't just look at something structurally and say it's a gene. It's just a specific subsequence somewhere. The sequence of DNA nucleotides between genes are so-called non-coding regions because those don't get transcribed. The genes get transcribed. And so the cell has to be able to recognize where genes begin and end. It might surprise you just how much of this non-coding other DNA there is between your genes. First of all, speaking of genes, do you have a feel for how many humans have? The number of genes, of course, depends on species, but we really had no idea how many human genes there were until we did the Human Genome Project, which I think was in 2000, something like that. But do you know how many we discovered we have, roughly? No idea?
So roughly 20,000-ish or 23,000.
Yes. And that surprised the hell out of us. We thought it would be many more. But it might surprise you even more that when you consider all of the DNA sequence, combination of all of your 23 chromosomes, it's 23 pieces, but it's, you know, you can think of it as one enormously long sequence. That's what the human genome sequence is. 99% of that is non-coding DNA. So these gaps between the genes is really most of your DNA. And that, we're still learning a lot about what it's for. Some of it might not be for anything. It might just be junk DNA that's accumulated over evolutionary time. But anyway, the genes are the sequences that are actually used for transcriptions, for transcription, and each gene specifies some RNA. Each protein coding gene specifies a certain mRNA sequence. Okay, now think back to the other use of DNA, which we've addressed in the previous chapter. That other use of DNA is replication, right? In replication, both of the two strands of a DNA were important and were used, right? Because in DNA replication, each strand by itself was used as a template for how to build a copy of the other strand. Both strands were used in DNA replication. Well, now we're talking about transcription. There are still two DNA strands, of course. That's how DNA is. It's two-stranded. But for transcription, only one of the two strands is used. Now, remember that either of the two major functions of DNA, replication or transcription, requires the two strands to be separated from each other because you have to read that sequence. So we talked about the separation of the two strands, which is what helicase does in DNA replication, right? Well, you have to separate the two strands for transcription as well, but not along the entire length, just at one gene. like this blue one that we're seeing just a little bit of right here. This isn't the whole gene. This is just this little piece of gene 1. Anyway, you have to separate the two strands in order to read the sequence. But in transcription, you're only interested in reading one of those strands, not the other. So when you separate the two, one of them gets temporarily ignored, just gotten out of the way for the process of transcription, and the other one gets read. That one that gets read is called the DNA template strand. Now, in this cartoon version, it happens to be the top strand. And this, you know, we've uncurled it, so it's not a helix anymore. But this top strand will go on, both strands will go on and on, right, for the whole length. Eventually, you'll get to another gene. Point I'm trying to make is that it's not necessarily going to be that same strand that is the template strand in the next gene. It's on a gene-by-gene basis as to which of the two strands is the template strand and which one is unused, or the non-template strand. But why does it make sense that only one strand is used in transcription? That's a good guess, but no. Think about what you're trying to build. What were you trying to build in DNA replication? What were you trying to build in DNA replication? That's not a difficult question. DNA, right? Yeah, you're trying to build DNA in DNA replication. And DNA is a double-stranded nucleic acid. What are you trying to build in transcription? RNA, which is a single-stranded nucleic acid. So it requires only one strand of DNA to specify it. That's the point. That's why the other strand of DNA is not going to be used in the process of transcription. Only one of them is, and that's the template strand. Okay, so there's a specific sequence of A's, T's, and C's, and G's making up the template strand of the gene. We used complementarity rules before for replication. A always with T and vice versa, C always with G and vice versa. We're going to use complementarity also in transcription. But remember that RNA does not use thymine, it uses uracil instead. So if you read A in DNA, complementary to A in RNA is not T, since T is not used, it's U instead. C specifies G, T specifies A, G specifies C, but A specifies U. All right, so it's still complementarity, and it's strict complementarity. It's just slightly different because of U instead of T. Now, the top one here in blue is the template strand. The bottom one is the non-template strand. The red one is the messenger RNA, which is complementary to the template strand. But that means the RNA that gets produced is just like the non-template strand, except having U's instead of T's. Right? Because the non-template strand, of course, is complementary to the template strand. It's all DNA, two strands are complementary. See what I'm saying here? So even though this is the strand that's not being read, the messenger RNA ends up just like it, except U's instead of T's. Because we're reading the one that's complementary to it. All right, now this is transcription. Like I said, it's not a language change. We're reading the code in the language of nucleotides, and we're writing the transcript in the language of nucleotides, just RNA instead of DNA. And therefore, there is a one-to-one correspondence Well, to explain that further, how many types of nucleotides are there in DNA normally? Four. And how many in RNA? Four. So there can be a one-to-one correspondence between DNA nucleotide in the gene and RNA nucleotide in the messenger RNA. What I mean by a one-to-one correspondence is that a single DNA nucleotide specifies a single RNA nucleotide. That's nice and simple. It would be very nice if we could maintain that simplicity for translation and have one RNA nucleotide specify one amino acid. But we can't. Why is that impossible? Why can't you use just one RNA nucleotide to specify an amino acid? Yeah. Right, you would be able to specify four amino acids that way, right? Because there are four different kinds of RNA nucleotides. If each one stood for an amino acid, you'd be able to specify four amino acids. Well, the cell would be dead, right? Because you have to be able to specify all 20 biological amino acids, not just four. Every protein gets its function because of its shape. It gets its shape because of its specific sequence of the 20 types of amino acids. So you have to be able to specify all 20 biological amino acids in order for any functional protein to be built. You can't do that if you only have four ways of specifying with one RNA nucleotide. And therefore, even though it would be nice, it can't work. So the next simplest possibility would be to use two RNA nucleotides as a single code to specify an amino acid. Well, if there are four kinds of RNA nucleotides, or categories, how many two-letter sequences are possible? 16, 4 times 4. Because for each of the four first digit, there's four possibilities for the second digit. 4 times 4. Well, 16 is still fewer than 20. So that can't work either, right? You would only be able to specify 16 amino acids that way. No proper proteins could be built. The cell couldn't live. So the next simplest possibility would be to use three, right? Sequence of three RNA nucleotides. Well, how many three-digit possibilities are there? Four. 64. 4 times 4 times 4. 64 is greater than 20. You only needed 20. But 64 is the smallest number that is greater than or equal to 20 that is possible using mRNA. And therefore, a sequence of three mRNA nucleotides specifying one amino acid is the simplest possible way of doing it. And that's exactly why that got favored by natural selection. It is the simplest. All right? This is also why you can see here the brackets being used to treat one sequence of three mRNA nucleotides as a unit. Any nucleotide sequence that's three nucleotides long is called a triplet, whether it's DNA or RNA. For mRNA, we call the triplets that correspond to amino acids codons. So one codon is a triplet, three nucleotides long, of RNA that specifies one amino acid. You can see that this first codon corresponds to tryptophan. That's what TRP stands for. The next one corresponds to phenylalanine, and so on. So there is not a one-to-one correspondence in translation like there is in transcription. Instead, there's a three-to-one correspondence. Three mRNA nucleotides uniquely specify one amino acid. And once the messenger RNA transcript is formed, DNA's job is done, because its job was simply to tell the cell how to make that mRNA transcript. The mRNA transcript is then used at a ribosome, which reads the codons one at a time, the ribosome does, and that's what tells the ribosome which specific amino acid to add next as it creates a longer and longer polypeptide. That's what translation is. That's when the polypeptide is actually built. Okay. Let's go on to four. This is an exhaustive listing of all 64 possible codons, messenger RNA codons. The codons are listed as all cap triplets. So these are messenger RNA codons. The ones that are three letters but not all caps are abbreviations for the 20 different amino acids. Don't memorize which ones are which, but all 20 are listed up there. But this is all 64 possible RNA codons arranged in a table that we call the genetic code. This is the genetic code. And it is the genetic code. This is not the genetic code for just humans or for just pineapples or for just whales or whatever, or bacteria. All organisms use this same genetic code. It's universal. And this is one of the strongest bits of evidence pointing to the fact that all organisms have descended from the same original successful lineage of cells billions of years ago. We all are descendants of those original cells. That's why we all use the same code. So all 64 are listed here. 60 of them are in lavender, unless that's periwinkle, but this purplish color. Those are just kind of ordinary codons in the sense that each one specifies an amino acid. But then there are the four that have a different function. One is in green. AUG is the only one. And it actually does double duty. It is the so-called start codon, one of its jobs. As we'll see eventually in this chapter, when it comes time to translate the code that's in messenger RNA into a polypeptide, the ribosome that's responsible for assembling that polypeptide has to know where the first word is, where the first codon is, where to start reading the code, in other words. And that's what the start codon tells it. AUG is always the first codon to be read. Well, the other duty of AUG, though, is that it specifies methionine. So in this respect, it's just like all the purple ones. Every time you see an AUG, that tells the ribosome methionine is the proper amino acid to lay down here. But since it's also the start codon, that means that every polypeptide starts out with methionine as the first amino acid, whether it's supposed to be there or not, because there's only one start codon and it also specifies methionine. This brings up the point that when translation is done, that's not necessarily the end of the line as far as getting the protein to work. For instance, polypeptides that aren't supposed to have methionine in them as the first amino acid, but they have to because that's the start codon that specified it, they have to remove that methionine after translation, after it's built. That's an example of post-translational modification. But anyway, that's the two functions of AUG. Start codon and it specifies methionine. Now, it's only a start codon once within a messenger RNA, right? Because it's at the beginning. But you can have AUG multiple times after that. It's just no longer a start codon. It's just saying methionine at these positions. Notice the orange ones, though, those are all labeled as stop codons. And there's three different stop codons, but they are completely interchangeable as far as their function is concerned. It doesn't matter at all which one of these three is used. Only one is used in each mRNA molecule, because as soon as a ribosome encounters any one of these three, it knows it's done, and it won't keep translating beyond that point. Notice, though, that unlike the start codon, the stop codons don't specify any amino acid. So amino acids will be added one at a time according to the codons, the purple ones, and then the ribosome will get to a stop codon. It won't add any more amino acids at that point. It just the stop codon simply tells it you've already added the last one, now you're done. Okay, now on to mentioning two really important properties of the genetic code. One property is that the genetic code is redundant. And the other is that it is not ambiguous. So it's really important for you to understand what these words mean in everyday language. What does it mean to be redundant? Right, repetitive. I said that the genetic code is redundant. That simply is because 64 is greater than 20. You have 64 codons that you can work with. You have to specify only 20 biological amino acids, which means you can have more than one codon specify the same amino acid. It's kind of like synonyms in language, right? There are multiple different words you can use that mean the same thing. Similarly with the genetic code. You can see this with the brackets. So it is for leucine, which is one of the amino acids. There are six different codons. It doesn't matter which one of those is used, it specifies leucine. Just different ways of saying leucine is the amino acid to use here. That's redundancy, simply because there are more than 20 codons. Therefore, it's redundant. The other property, though, is that the genetic code is not ambiguous. So what does it mean in everyday language to be ambiguous?
Non-specific.
Right. Ambiguity is a specific kind of vagueness. To be ambiguous means to be vague because there are multiple possible meanings. Now, an easy to understand example is the phrase, I'm hot. That can have at least four different, radically different meanings. For instance, it can mean that I have an elevated body temperature. It can mean that I am a very popular celebrity at the moment, right? Or that I am very angry. Or that I'm sexually attractive. And maybe even more meanings, but that's four at least. Totally different meanings, right? So it would be easy to get the wrong message. Well, that would be a big deal in translation, because that would involve ending up making the wrong protein, which would not work for what it's supposed to do, because it would have a different shape since it has a different sequence of amino acids. So the genetic code cannot be ambiguous, and it isn't. If it were ambiguous, you would see it in the genetic code. I mean, what would happen, is that a single codon would tell the cell, this is the amino acid this time, and then another time that same codon is read, it would specify some other amino acid. It would have multiple meanings, a codon. Well, you don't see that in the genetic code. Notice that every single three-letter, all caps, codon specifies exactly one amino acid, not two or more. So every time any of the 61 codons that specify amino acids is read, that codon is going to specify the same amino acid every time. That's non-ambiguity. And therefore, you end up making the right polypeptide for the job. All right. Let's go on to five. You have two photographs here that you might be tempted to think have been retouched or colorized after they were taken. That's not true, though. These two organisms are actually glowing, which is, neither one of them has any natural business glowing, right? Tobacco plants don't normally glow. Pigs don't normally glow. But these ones actually are. And that's because they've been genetically modified. A gene that is normally found in a firefly, which naturally glows, has been put into a tobacco plant when it was just one cell big. Once you get that gene in there, then it just naturally becomes two cells. It doesn't know it's a foreign gene. It just includes it along with the rest of its DNA. And then, you know, if you start with just one cell, then the entire body of the organism will have that new DNA as well as you let it grow up. Similarly for the pig, which got a gene at the one cell stage from a jellyfish, which naturally glows. So this, first of all, reminds you of something that I've said many times already this term, namely that an organism's traits come directly from its proteins, right? The trait of glowing comes from the fact that you have to have the right kind of protein to be able to do that glowing reaction. Well, any organism is stuck with being able to make only certain kinds of proteins because they have to be told how to make those proteins, even though any given protein is possible. A cell has to be told how to build it, and it can't be told how to build it unless it has the gene for it. That's why you're stuck with the traits you were given because of the DNA you got at birth. Here, though, it's been modified. The main question, though, here is, these are drastically different organisms. A tobacco plant is not very closely related to a firefly, and neither is a pig to a jellyfish. So how does a gene that works in a firefly to code for the protein that allows glowing work in a tobacco plant to produce the same protein? How does the tobacco plant, how is it able to use a gene that came from a totally different kind of organism? Why does it still end up producing the same protein in the different organism? Exactly. Because of the universality of the genetic code. It is the genetic code. It's not the firefly's genetic code only. It's all organisms' genetic code. So if you take a gene from one organism and put it into another organism, it will still make the same protein because there's only one genetic code. All right, those 64 that I showed you, that's true for all organisms. Okay, let's go on to the particulars of transcription, starting with 6. Transcription as a process, as you can see on the left edge here, occurs in 3 phases. These are nicely descriptive names for these phases: initiation, elongation, termination. Initiation, of course, refers to getting it started, initiated. Elongation refers to the fact that the mRNA transcript that's being built gets longer and longer as you add one more nucleotide at a time. And then termination, of course, refers to putting it to an end. At the upper left, you have a double-stranded DNA which is just one gene of that chromosome, however long it is. But remember that only one of the two strands is going to be used in the process of transcription. The seafoam green sequence right here is a sequence of A's, T's, and G's that is called the promoter, but that specific sequence tells the cell this is the beginning of the gene. So like I said before, it's a gene is not something structurally that you can look at and recognize. It's just a specific sequence. Well, the cell has to be able to tell where that sequence starts, and that's what the promoter tells the cell. But it's part of DNA, the promoter. The promoter is also, though, a region at which the egg-shaped thing, which in this cartoon version is egg-shaped, that's called RNA polymerase, of course, an enzyme. The promoter is the region at which the RNA polymerase molecule binds to the DNA to get things started. So RNA polymerase is named, just like DNA polymerase was named, for the fact that it's going to polymerize, in other words, build a polymer. In this case, it's building a polymer of RNA. That hasn't started yet, but first, before it works as an enzyme to do that, RNA polymerase recognizes a promoter sequence and binds to the DNA. That's what initiation is. After it binds, just like we've been saying before, you have to separate the two strands in order to read the sequence in one strand. Just like for replication, right? Helicase did that job, but RNA polymerase does the job of separating the two strands after it binds to the promoter. And that's the very next step. But as soon as you have the two strands separated, one of them is ignored. That's the non-template strand. The template strand is read by the sequence in the template strand is read by RNA polymerase. And the RNA transcript begins being built one RNA nucleotide at a time. Each additional DNA nucleotide that's read in the template strand specifies one more RNA nucleotide in the RNA transcript. That's what elongation is. It's getting, the transcript is getting longer and longer, the red thing here. When you think back to DNA replication, we had to start that by adding a primer, right? What enzyme was responsible for that? Primase, named for the fact that it lays down a primer. What is a primer?
Foundation for what's to come?
Well, yes, but I mean specifically in DNA replication. Not the everyday use of the word, the biological use of the word. What is a primer? It's an RNA sequence, yes. This, even though you're trying to build DNA in replication, you have to put down RNA, right? Because DNA can't be laid down onto nothing. Well, you don't have that complication here because you're not trying to build DNA, right? You're trying to build RNA. So you don't have anything called a primer. You just start laying down RNA nucleotides that will become part of the final product, the RNA transcript. And you just make it longer and longer. One DNA nucleotide at a time gets read to specify one RNA nucleotide in the transcript. And in the process, RNA polymerase moves down the length of the gene, separating the two strands locally, but behind the enzyme, after it's already been read, the two strands nicely go back together because they're still complementary to each other. They haven't been changed, and they will fit with hydrogen bonds perfectly together. All right, so that's elongation, and notice the RNA transcript is coming off of this assembly line, basically. Termination just refers to the fact that eventually the RNA polymerase will encounter the end of the gene, and all of these three things will come apart. The RNA polymerase will detach from both of these others, and the RNA transcript is now on its own. The DNA is back to normal. And, by the way, the DNA's job is done as far as gene expression is concerned at this point. All it had to do was tell the cell how to build the RNA. It's not involved in translation. DNA is not. RNA, of course, is, which is why you build it. So what's labeled here as completed RNA transcript, that refers to the fact that transcription is complete. But it doesn't necessarily mean that RNA is ready to go. If it is a prokaryotic cell in which this transcription is occurring, then it is ready to go for translation. Prokaryotic cells don't have to modify the RNA after transcription. But if it's a eukaryotic cell, then this so-called completed RNA transcript is not actually ready. Transcription is completed, but the RNA has to undergo what is called post-transcriptional modification, which occurs only in eukaryotic cells. All right, it's not part of transcription. That's what post-transcriptional means. After transcription is when this occurs. Seven, we'll get back into post-transcriptional modification in a second, but seven, we're looking at something that applies to eukaryotic cells also in this slide. You can see a promoter here, and like I said before, the promoter is the region where RNA polymerase has to bind as part of initiation. If RNA polymerase doesn't bind to the promoter, then the gene is off. It's not being expressed. And that's usually the case. You know, that's why your liver is not making toenails. It has the ability to because it has the whole library. But you don't want your liver to start growing toenails. So those genes are turned off in that cell, meaning that RNA polymerase won't bind to the promoter of that gene. It'll stay off. But while it is true that RNA polymerase has to bind to a promoter to initiate transcription, it sometimes needs help in order to do that. And I'm specifically talking about eukaryotic cells. In other words, RNA polymerase by itself in a eukaryotic cell can't bind to the promoter of the gene. Instead, first, there have to be other proteins that bind in that promoter region. I say other proteins because keep in mind RNA polymerase as an enzyme is a protein itself, right? But before it has the ability to bind to the promoter region, other proteins called transcription factors have to be present in the cell so that they can bind in that region first. And then RNA polymerase can come along and bind to the promoter. And there can be several different transcription factors, all of which have to be present before there is eventually RNA polymerase binding. In other words, the gene will remain off until all of the required transcription factors are present and bound so that the polymerase can then bind. Now, this is an additional complication compared to prokaryotic transcription. So you might say, well, why have this extra complication? It's much easier if RNA polymerase simply can bind by itself to the promoter, and that's true. It is a lot simpler. But this allows for much greater control over gene expression. In other words, control over whether or not that gene is allowed to be turned on. Because each of these individual transcription factors is kind of like a switch, and you have to throw a certain number of switches. All of them have to be thrown in order for the gene to be turned on. This is also another use of that word factor. Like I was talking about in the control of the cell cycle, I said that there's many different proteins that are called factors in cells. Well, these are transcription factors. They are proteins. Where do transcription factors come from? Well, they're proteins. Where do proteins come from? From where? Yes, ribosomes create them. That's the whole process we're looking at right here, right? Translation, well, we're looking at transcription. Translation produces polypeptides. But how does a ribosome know how to translate? From RNA, messenger RNA, and where does that come from? Transcription of genes, right? What I'm trying to get at here is that these transcription factors are proteins. So they are the ultimate product, each one individually, of a specific gene somewhere else in the genome. You have a gene whose job it is to make a messenger RNA, whose job it is to produce a specific transcription factor, which then, if that happens, that transcription factor interacts with a totally different gene to help turn it on. So the product of one gene is partially controlling the expression of other genes. That's what transcription factors are all about. All right? Eukaryotic cells use them extensively. That brings us to 8. Well, since eukaryotic cells have to post-transcriptionally modify their mRNA, the mRNA that comes directly off of the transcription assembly line in a eukaryotic cell is therefore called pre-mRNA to indicate that it's not yet ready for translation. We don't use the phrase pre-mRNA for a prokaryotic cell because it is ready in a prokaryote. There's two major ways in which that we're going to study in this course in which eukaryotic mRNA gets post-transcriptionally modified. One that you see in slide 8. The red part here is what was directly produced by transcription. That's pre-mRNA. It's already been modified, as you can see, because it has these yellow ends. That's not the only modification, but that's the first important modification. Any sequence of any kind of nucleic acid, remember, has a 5' end and a 3' end. That applies to RNA as well. So at the 5' end of the pre-mRNA transcript, you have a so-called 5' cap that's added. And at the other end, the 3' end, a poly-A tail is added, named for the fact that it's really just adenine over and over. Those are not specified by the gene. That's added to the pre-mRNA transcript after transcription is done in a eukaryotic cell. The reason that these are so important, these ends, 5' cap and poly-A tail, is because of what I said mRNA has to face as an impediment in a eukaryotic cell that it doesn't have to face in a prokaryotic cell. Specifically, the need to get through the nuclear envelope. A pre-mRNA without these ends, these yellow ends in this cartoon, cannot get through the nuclear pores. So that's an important part of eukaryotic post-transcriptional modification, these two ends. It's still, though, pre-mRNA, because even though you've already modified it a little bit, there's more modification that's going to happen. What I didn't mention yet about this figure are these UTRs. That simply stands for untranslated region. A translated region of mRNA is a sequence that is used as codons, meaning that it's going to be read to specify amino acids in the process of translation. So it gets translated. Well, remember I said that a ribosome, which is reading the codons, needs to know where the first codon is. That's the purpose of the start codon, AUG. And that's not at the very beginning of the mRNA. It's somewhere into the sequence. So wherever the start codon is, that's where translation begins. Upstream of that, there's an untranslated region. It's important for reasons of docking to the ribosome, but it's not going to be read as codons. And then as soon as you get to a stop codon, however many codons later after the start codon, which will depend on the gene, then that's the end of translation, of course. Well, there's an untranslated region after that as well. Now to 9. This is the other important part of eukaryotic post-transcriptional modification of messenger RNA. So it's still considered pre-mRNA at the top, even though it's already been modified somewhat. It's not yet ready to go, because you can see what's happening in the red range is that there are dark red regions and light red regions. The dark red regions, notice, are labeled as exons, and the light red as introns. The X part of the word exon is short for expressed, meaning that the exons are sequences that will be used in the final version of mRNA as codons. And they therefore will be read by the ribosome to specify amino acids in the polypeptide. The int part of intron, the word intron, is short for intervening sequence. So introns are sequences that intervene or come between the exons. But the introns are not going to be in the final version of mRNA, because they get cut out as this final part of post-transcriptional modification. And to do that, the cell needs to know where the beginning and end of each intron is, so it can recognize those introns. And not only cut them out, but importantly, sew together the exons end-to-end in the proper sequence. Can't allow it to be scrambled. The introns, though, are removed, and they won't be in the final product, but they are still valuable because they're sequences of RNA nucleotides. They'll be digested into individual nucleotides and just be part of the RNA nucleotide pool. So the next moment, it could be the part of another mRNA from a different gene. It's just, you know, it's just part of the mRNA pool's veil. It's recycled. They're not going to be part of the final version, though, the so-called mature mRNA, which means completely modified now and ready to go for the purpose of translation. Notice that it's shorter than the pre-mRNA, and that's because the introns have been removed. And the exons have been spliced together. So this final bit of post-transcriptional modification is called pre-mRNA splicing, which occurs only in eukaryotic cells. It's also not part of transcription. Transcription's been done already. That's what produced the pre-mRNA originally. But it's between transcription and translation, because translation can't start until you have the final version of mRNA, which is after splicing occurs. All right, I'll stop there. Start with splicing on the next slide next time.